President Obama's poll numbers have dipped to the lowest in his presidency. But how do his approval ratings compare with past presidents? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we look back at the Bush, Clinton, and Reagan eras, and even back to Herbert Hoover, to find out what caused stormy political weather in their presidencies and how it compares with President Obama's troubles after the rollout of the new health care law. My guests, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa and presidential historian Tim Walsh. How presidents deal with unpopularity. Politics Day after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day has arrived this Wednesday, and we're joined by Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, where she is their director of their political science department. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I am doing fine. Presidential historian Tim Walsh is with us as well in our Iowa City studio, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim Walsh, thank you for coming in.
Good to be with you both.
Well, we have a grand plan for this hour to look at ebbing and flowing of approval ratings among recent presidents. And before we do that, let's get caught up on the latest presidency, the American public expressing serious doubts about the implementation of the new health care law. And this has sent President Obama's ratings to a new low. Tuesday morning, a poll released by the Washington Post and ABC News finds that his approval rating down 42%, with a record 55% disapproving. That's down significantly from October, slightly worse than his previous low point of 54% disapproval. That was in late 2011. At a recent press conference, President Obama answered a question about whether he needs to regain public trust after the problems with the exchange website and some people's insurance policy cancellations.
You know, I understand why folks are frustrated. I would be too, because sometimes, you know, people look at what's taking place in Washington and they say, not enough is getting done that helps me with my life. And, you know, regardless of what Congress does, ultimately I'm the President of the United States, and they expect me to do something about it. So in terms of how I intend to approach it, I'm just going to keep on working as hard as I can around the priorities that the American people care about. And I think it's legitimate for them to expect me to have to win back some credibility on this health care law in particular and on a whole range of these issues in general. And, you know, that's on me. I mean, we fumbled the rollout on this health care law.
President Obama, recently, he went on to say that many parts of the law have already been getting overshadowed by these problems. This hour, we want to take a look at how President Obama's lower approval ratings compare with past presidents, how past presidents have dealt with unpopularity, and how much public approval matters anyway in governing this country. And so let's look at, for instance, Donna Hoffman, tell us, before we get into comparing with other presidents, track a little bit. What can you say about the nearly five years of the Obama presidency in terms of presidential popularity and approval?
Well, first of all, let's talk about presidential popularity and approval. And note that we can make too much of this because it is difficult sometimes to tell what that tracks. It is popularity. We talk about it in terms of approval. But sometimes it will tap into economic factors. Sometimes it will tap into foreign policy factors. And sometimes it will tap into things that are happening domestically, as we kind of see right now happening with the Affordable Care Act rollout and President Obama. And so, you know, Obama started off in his presidency fairly popular, but it is also another thing when we compare presidents. You know, we don't have public approval polls on George Washington, for example, or presidents much before Truman. There are a few on FDR. They're not really all that reliable many times. And so from Truman forward, we have this group of presidents, relatively small group. But even within that group, sometimes it is difficult to compare president to president in terms of their approval. If we think about, you know, Truman to Nixon, for example, presidential approval was one thing because the public had kind of this compendium of support for the presidency. But Vietnam erodes that. Watergate erodes that. And so from Nixon forward, and even LBJ to some in some respects, we have different things happening with presidential approval. Then you get to kind of another era when we get to Clinton, because with the Clinton era, and this would include Clinton and Bush and Obama, things become very partisan in terms of how partisans are registering their approval or disapproval of presidents as well. And so we have to be very careful with these measures and ask, well, what really might it be measuring? And take it with a grain of salt to some degree. Having said that, it's not an unimportant figure. Having higher approval can get you leeway with Congress, for example. But, you know, in respect with Obama, even if he had a high approval rate at this point, Congress is still not going to do his bidding because of the nature of divided government in Congress at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Tim Walsh, what do you see when you look at presidents' popularity over the past few decades in the modern era?
Right. Well, popularity has a tendency to go to the head of a presidential candidate. And if you go back, say, as far as FDR in 1936, he wins an overwhelming majority of the American people and attempts to use this in part to pack the Supreme Court. And there's what we might call today blowback against this effort to increase the number of justices and change the nature of divided government and checks and balances. And so presidents have to be careful. I recall President Bush 43, George W. Bush, talking about having political capital that he intended to spend. And he said that, I think, shortly after the election in 2004, his reelection. And then, of course, all hell broke loose. He had Katrina and then the economic crisis. And those 4 years of his second term were pretty bad for him, very, very difficult. It's rare in a way that the second term is as successful as the first term. And we talk about second term blues. And now that we have a president in a second term, it seems that we're following form.
Let's talk a little bit about George W. Bush, the president serving just before our current president served from 2001 to 2009. Popularity spiking to one of the all-time highs right after 9/11, up in the 90%, even or over 90%, I think. But let's go a little bit further into his presidency and listen to a bit of George W. Bush, the mission accomplished banner that served as the backdrop for President Bush. This was May 1st, 2003, a speech probably better remembered than the words he spoke from an aircraft carrier, USS Abraham Lincoln, with that mission accomplished banner in the background.
Yeah! Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed. And now our coalition is engaged in securing and reconstructing that country. In this battle, we have fought for the cause of liberty and for the peace of the world. Our nation and our coalition are proud of this accomplishment. Yet it is you, the members of the United States military, who achieved it. Your courage, your willingness to face danger for your country and for each other, made this day possible.
President George W. Bush, May 1st, 2003. If it had been as simple as many of us were thinking at that time, Tim Walsh, what went wrong here?
Well, what went wrong, first of all, we talk about hubris, the expectation after only 2 months that the war essentially was over. I think it was compounded, as you suggested, by that banner, which after the fact, several years later, as the war dragged on, the president's friends and associates said they weren't responsible for the banner, that somebody else had put that banner up. So sometimes you can be hurt by your friends taking to an exuberant level the boasting of your accomplishments. And if they don't follow through, then it leads to a precipitous fall. And that was the case, certainly, as the war dragged on. You did have the reinforcement of troops and so forth. But it's a war of mixed results, and it will forever affect George W. Bush's legacy as far as his presidency is concerned.
Donna Hoffman, what do you think of when you think of presidential approval during those 8 years of George W. Bush?
Well, George W. Bush is really interesting. And we must say that there are various entities that measure presidential approval. If you look at them, you mentioned that George W. Bush had the highest public approval rating ever. It was the highest. He surpassed his father in the Gallup polls anyway by one percentage point. So his approval in the aftermath of 9/11 got up to 90%. At the same time, we see that erode. And actually, usually these things that we call rally events, these international events that cause this really big spike in presidential approval, usually it dissipates fairly quickly. That was not the case with the effect of 9/11. It dissipates really pretty slowly. But at the same time, we have the mission accomplished. We have Katrina. We have various things that erode the public's support of President Bush. The wars both in Iraq and Afghanistan drag on. And he is seen as, flying above a flooded New Orleans, and his approval slowly ticks down. And, in October of 2008, right before he would leave office, he essentially ties Truman as the least unpopular or least popular president with an approval rating of about 25%. And so there's an interesting, contrast there with Bush being at one point the most popular president recorded and one of the very least popular presidents recorded. Mm-hmm. And it goes to show that, presidents continually have to pay attention to this. But at the same time, Bush was still able to accomplish things, even though his approval ratings were low. And in the second term, when presidents are no longer concerned with reelection because they constitutionally can't stand for reelection any longer, they are still concerned about this because they do care what history thinks of them. And as Tim mentioned, this is going to be something that the Bush legacy is saddled with probably forever. It is also important, though, to think about how presidential legacies do over time evolve. And so, when President Truman left office in his second term, he was very unpopular. And after 1950, his approval ratings never got above 50%. But if we think of Truman's legacy now, he is consistently in the top usually 7 or 8 of the greatest presidents when you ask historians that particular question. And so over time, as historians get into the records, as political scientists study the things that happened within administrations, many times those legacies go through transitions. They get revisited. And that certainly happened with Truman. It happened with Eisenhower. And so, again, the public approval of a president is not the be-all and end-all of a presidency. And time does have to lend some perspective in terms of how we look back on that particular period and that particular president.
Tim, you mentioned that the mission accomplished banner was not placed by the Bush administration. Can you think of other instances in history when a president had to go back and explain the action not specifically taken by his administration, but someone else supportive of a particular action?
Well, it reminds me of a story about Warren Harding. Harding, of course, had this terrible Teapot Dome scandal where members of his cabinet were selling off oil reserves. And of course, he was widely criticized for it, and his popularity was plummeting. And somebody said to him, "Mr. President, how are you dealing with your enemies?" And he said, "It's not my enemies I have to worry about. It's my damn friends." And very often it is, unfortunately, the friends of the president who contribute to the problem as well. And that's certainly when you go back farther in history, that was the case with U.S. Grant and other presidencies that have scandals. It's often friends who tie themselves to the popularity of their close friend, the president, and then take license with the office and do horrible things. Donna raises an interesting point that I want to emphasize, because this whole question about legacy and your popularity is what pervades presidential libraries from time to time. And, of course, we just opened a new presidential library for President George W. Bush. And I'm guessing, I don't know for a fact, but I'm guessing he's looking at the attendance figures for people visiting his museum and comparing them, say, to the Johnson Library or to his father's library or to the Reagan presidential library. These men, this far, still men, are very competitive, even with those who've passed on. So that the idea is they are polishing their legacy. There are people who refer to presidential libraries as the third term, which I like that, because there is, to some extent, while the president is still alive, a desire to continue to polish history, to make sure their voice is heard among the American people.
Jimmy Carter is a great example. A great example of the known as the best post president.
Interestingly enough, when Carter's library opened, he thought he was closing a chapter on the past and going forward, and realized many years later that you have to go back and revisit your presidential exhibits. And so, about 10 years ago, maybe even less, he raised a significant amount of money to redo the exhibits. There's a brand new exhibit at the Carter Library which talks about the Carter presidency in context. He does hope that the current generation looks back on the one term of his presidency, which was fraught with disasters and low points, and sees it through the prism of the good work he's done over the last 30 years.
Okay, while you're there, let's go listen to a little bit of Jimmy Carter. This is his 1980 State of the Union Address, his popularity eroding, as you mentioned, Tim Walsh. President Jimmy Carter delivered this State of the Union Address.
The 1980s have been born in turmoil, strife, and change. This is a time of challenge to our interests and our values, and it's a time to test our wisdom and our skills. At this time in Iran, 50 Americans are still held captive, innocent victims of terrorism and anarchy. Also at this moment, massive Soviet troops are attempting to subjugate the fiercely independent and deeply religious people of Afghanistan. These two acts, one of international terrorism and one of military aggression, present a serious challenge to the United States of America and indeed to all the nations of the world. Together, we will meet these threats to peace. I'm determined that the United States will remain the strongest of all nations, but our power will never be used to initiate a threat to the security of any nation or to the rights of any human being. We seek to be and to remain secure, a nation at peace in a stable world.
Okay, President Jimmy Carter, State of the Union Address, 1980. Of course, 1980, later on in that year, Jimmy Carter to be unseated by a former Hollywood actor who served from 81 to 89, President Reagan. Your thoughts on the Carter presidency, Donna Hoffman?
Well, it's interesting that you played that particular clip of Jimmy Carter in his State of the Union Address of 1980, because after his initial honeymoon, which would have occurred in 1977, where he had relatively high rates, in January of 1980 is when he hits his highest in terms of that part of his term. He hits 58%. And there's an example of where, you know, he's talking about the really bad news. In the scope of about 3 months, we have the hostages taken in Iran and the Soviets invade Afghanistan. And even though those were negative events in terms of these are, you know, really bad things happening, his approval goes up. And this is the nature of international events and the effect that they often have on presidential approval. This notion of a rally event, it's called that because people rally around the flag. It usually picks up patriotism. Mm-hmm. And so when you know, collectively the United States is seen as being attacked, more or less, this effect usually happens. And so if you look at Carter's approval rating before the hostages were taken, in November of 1979, he was at 32%. He was fairly low. After they're taken, the next time approval's measured with him, it's at 51%. And so that was an increase of about 19 points. And part of that can be attributed to the notion of people were feeling patriotic. The United States, in essence, had been attacked, and we picked that up. And the same is true of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And so with that particular event, you know, at the time he's giving that State of the Union address, his approval rating is about 58%.
Mm-hmm. If we take a similar moment out of the current presidency, wouldn't it be for President Obama a high point of his presidency in terms of popularity right after the announcement of the death of Osama bin Laden?
You did have a spike there, and but it wasn't actually as large as sometimes you see there. And part of that is the effect of extreme partisanship that we have in terms of presidential approval. So there was a bit of a blip there with it, but it wasn't as large as some of the other rally events that we've seen.
Donna makes a very good point, because when the nation is attacked, we do rally around our presidents. It does give them a spike of public approval. I think where they tend to drop to low points is when they've taken an action themselves, a policy of some sort, where they're the prime mover, like the Affordable Health Care Act, that doesn't quite work is when there's a sort of a blowback from the American people. We can be a churlish kind of people, and if something doesn't go right, we want someone to blame. And in many cases, our presidents have, during their campaigns, promised things they probably know they can't deliver. And so they're being hoisted on their own petard by the people of the opposite party, saying, you promised you were going to deliver affordable health care. You lied, they often say. Well, it's not a lie necessarily, but it wasn't quite the truth. And so presidents struggle and squirm, in the face of lowering popularity.
We want to take a short break after a couple minutes, and we do want to address some other presidents and compare their popularity, approval ratings with the current presidents. But before we do take that break, what lessons are there now that would be useful to President Obama's advisors at this point in an ebbing point in his popularity? Donna Hoffman, can you think?
Well, it's not as if, you know, his advisors are sitting around saying, turn to foreign policy. But we oftentimes do see presidents turn to foreign policy, especially in their second term, especially when they're being stymied by Congress because they have a freer hand in foreign policy. So, you know, we may see Obama really try to take up negotiations with Iran. The administration has been moving there. The president hasn't been personally involved in those yet. But, you know, we may see things there. But that's not unusual because presidents, again, want to they pay attention to their legacy. They want to show that they are successful, that they can govern, and they have an easier time of it with foreign policy many times.
Absolutely. And I also think that the advice would be, don't live in the moment. That is, think of this in terms of the long term of your presidency. This is his signature achievement. It is worth working for. It's something that many presidents before them have struggled for, health care for all. And so that you keep working at it. Persistence, when all else fails, persistence prevails.
Okay. Tim Walch is with us, presidential historian, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Donna Hoffman, one of our regular political experts on political analysts on Wednesday Politics. And we'd like to have you join our conversation. Still more to come. We'll go back and visit, particularly on this week. We want to hear some audio from John F. Kennedy talk about his popularity during his term cut short by that assassination 50 years ago. Also, President Nixon we'll hear from, President Reagan, and President Clinton. We hope you'll join our conversation with your thoughts on presidential approval, the ebbing and flowing. Does it matter? What are your questions? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, where we have a great Gallup poll interactive link. Check that out. It's river to river from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News Politics Day. I'm Ben Kiefer, and together with Tim Walch, our special guest on this Politics Day, presidential historian, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, Donna Hoffman with us in our Cedar Falls studio at the University of Northern Iowa. And we're taking the tack this hour to look at how the president's, the current president's approval ratings, which are ebbing, compare to past presidents. And how presidents deal with unpopularity, what causes it, how much does public approval matter anyway? And if you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. And you can leave a Facebook post. Incidentally, on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, we have a very slick interactive web page link to the Gallup organization we posted. It's really neat to look at how presidential approval is graphed out over these presidents' time. And you can perhaps put President Obama right next to President Clinton or President Nixon and see how their presidencies developed in terms of approval. And that's on our Facebook page. And let's turn to a president we haven't talked much about at this hour, President Clinton, serving from 1993 to 2001, and looking at his graph of presidential popularity. I see there, Donna, a fairly consistent popularity, but sort of a dip in the middle with a high end in the start of his presidency, and then continuing on and to the Lewinsky scandal and going up until the end, until he increases in popularity.
Yeah, Clinton is actually really interesting because the general pattern with presidents, and if people go to this website, they can see this, the general pattern over time of presidential approval is it goes down. And Clinton is the exception to that of the presidents that we have approval on, by and large. And he does. He actually ends his term more popular than he was for a lot of it. And certainly at the very beginning, more popular than he was at the very beginning. And the other thing that's really interesting about Clinton, and this gets into what I mentioned earlier about what really does this question measure, is that if you look at Clinton, you will see that the highest approval that he has in his presidency is 73%. It occurs on Gallup's poll, December 19th and 20th of 1998. He was impeached by the House of Representatives on December 19th. Of that year. And so what is that measuring? That essentially is measuring, one, a good economy, because we're in a 10-year expansion during this period of time, and two, the fact that the public really did not approve of what House Republicans were doing in terms of impeachment. And so, this is an example I use with students a lot, in talking about, well, what does this really mean? Well, what does it mean? And, you know, it's very complicated is the answer to that, and it depends. But, you know, we can ask the question, well, what does high approval get you? Well, high approval for Clinton, you know, still got him impeached by the House of Representatives. However, an interesting, you know, what if would be, the Senate then had to try him on impeachment, and they do so in February of 1999, and they acquit him. And so he was not removed from office. And the question becomes, though, well, if Clinton's approval, however, had been at 35%, would the Senate action have been the same with his approval? And at that point, it was down a little bit, but it was still very healthy. Would that have changed the outcome? And of course, we can't answer that question. But high approval, didn't get President Clinton didn't prevent him from being impeached. But, it may have helped in the fact that he was acquitted in the Senate.
Let's go back to hear some audio from President Clinton before that impeachment. This is January 26th of 1998. Here he is standing with his wife, speaking at the White House, a White House press conference, and issuing a forceful denial, which contained what would later become one of the best-known sound bites of his presidency.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Ms. Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie. Not a single time. Never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Tim Walsh, your reflections on the Clinton presidency.
Well, it is that high point and low point that Donna refers to. It's the flip side. That is, here's an event, the impeachment, which Republicans continue to push in the face of public unpopularity, and the American people rally around President Clinton. I think they show it much the same way that there probably was in the current controversy where President Obama is suffering from low approval ratings as a result of health care, but actually was holding his own in the face of the government shutdown, which was largely attributed to Republicans and considered very unpopular. So sometimes there are other events which mask the unpopularity of a presidential policy until much later. Mm-hmm.
Are there other sex scandals that have influenced the presidential popularity?
Well, I mean, there have been other sex scandals, but up until really the Clinton presidency, I can't think of a sex scandal that wasn't covered up by the media. I mean, obviously, we're learning a great deal about President Kennedy's sexual escapades as the documents have been opened and made available and so forth. But at the time, although obviously people closest to him knew about them, the general public had no knowledge, and the same was true with FDR. So president's image could be controlled a little better by their press secretaries.
Let's go back to listen a little bit from John F. Kennedy. This is April 21st. In talking about how his short presidency, how his popularity was proceeded then, that President John F. Kennedy delivering a news conference. This is 4 days after 1,500 exiles had invaded Cuba at the Bay of Pigs to talk about a low point in his presidency. The president refuses to respond to questions about the conflict, including the deaths of U.S. airmen involved in that effort.
Well, I would say that there are a good many Americans in the last 15 years who've served their country in a good many different ways, a good many abroad. Some of them have lost their lives. The United States government has not felt that it was helpful to our interests, which particularly in the struggle against this armed doctrine, which we're in struggle all around the world, to go into great details. Let me just say about these four men. They were serving their country. The flight that cost them their lives was a volunteer flight, and that they, because of the nature of their work, it has not been a matter of public record, as it might be in the case of soldiers or sailors. I can say that they were serving their country, and as I say, their work was volunteer.
President Kennedy, there's struggling for words, not as eloquent as we sometimes hear him in 1961. Donna Hoffman, how did the Bay of Pigs incident, the disaster there, influence his overall approval?
Well, it's another example of where you have a brief rally event. And you see it in Kennedy in a couple of places with the Cuban Missile Crisis as well. But again, the general pattern that you have with Kennedy is that overall decline with a few spikes here and there, which is what we typically see with presidents. And even though Kennedy's presidency was cut short, of course, with his assassination, at the point that he was, you know, going to Texas, he was doing that in part to boost his reelection chances. But he was at his lowest approval point at that time.
Absolutely. Donna's right. He had a miserable first term in terms of what he accomplished with Congress, and he was apprehensive that he might not win re-election, which is what the trip to Texas in the first place. And of course, it's very difficult now among historians and certainly the general public to look back on John F. Kennedy's presidency or John F. Kennedy as a leader and see him without having had the prism of the assassination in front of us. And so even to this day, and particularly as we come up to the 50th anniversary, people see John F. Kennedy as one of the most successful and important presidents of the United States.
Tim Walsh, you are the former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library
Indeed.
And Museum. JFK thought of as one of the most popular presidents. Here we have the only Iowa president
right.
thought of in history, rightly or wrongly. You will say, I know, wrongly, of course, as one of the least popular presidents. Track his time in office and what happened. He had, a few months before the great
seven months or so before the great crash. And you do have some accomplishments during the Hoover presidency, of course, but they are masked and eclipsed by the decline in the economy. Hoover was not as politically astute. He was a public servant who had been used to working behind the scenes. But as president of the United States, you have to work very much in public. He was somewhat reclusive and therefore, which is something that, of course, is attached to President Obama as well. That is not a glad hander and somebody who would be as interested in working with Congress. And so as the economy declined, people became more and more disaffected. And in 1932, he's running for re-election, and he's out on the hustings, and he's hearing the chant, "We want bread, we want bread." This is a memoir from his granddaughter, Margaret Hoover, who was shocked that people were so critical of her grandfather, who she dearly loved. And then, of course, for the rest of his life, say from 1933 when he left office to his death in 1964, he worked very, very hard to recover his reputation. As late as 1962, so shortly before his death, 2 years before his death, he was generally accorded a rating of average by the American people in terms of ratings.
So not much success in that resuscitation.
He went from low to the midpoint, but since his passing, and when a president passes away, we relook at them again, and he's dropped to the top of the lowest quarter, let's say.
Can we make similarities between his presidency and we just spoke of President Carter?
Well, in part, you know, one of the problems is usually when an external crisis takes place, like we are attacked during World War II at Pearl Harbor or something like that, we rally around our president. An economic crisis is somewhat different. And in effect, what's happened with both Carter, with hyperinflation in 79 and 80, and I think with President Hoover, is that we attribute economic policy to the administration, and it's the responsibility of the president to in effect recover. And failure to recover the economy is a reason for low popularity. And in fact, although Hoover tried a great many things in response to the Great Depression, he was not a do-nothing president, but it was ineffective in responding to the Great Collapse. And in fact, the first several years of the Roosevelt presidency were a struggle to fight against the ravages of economic collapse. The difference was Roosevelt knew how to rally the American people using things like fireside chats and speeches and so forth. He loved the American people. He knew how to rally the flag.
Tim Walsh is with us, presidential historian, along with Donna Hoffman at the University of Northern Iowa, taking time this Politics Wednesday to compare, well, since President Obama is incurring some low presidential approval ratings, we want to compare his low approval ratings with the experiences of past presidents. And when we talk about low, extremely low approval, we have to go to the Nixon presidency. Here's a bit of President Nixon. He, on November 17th, 1973, in a televised question and answer session with 400 Associated Press managing editors, President Nixon maintained his innocence in the Watergate case and delivered these famous lines.
And I want to say this to the television audience. I made my mistakes, but in all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent. And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I can say that in my years of public life, that I welcome this kind of examination, because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
President Nixon, November 17th, 1973. Donna Hoffman, take us through the Nixon presidency.
Well, you know, that's 1973, and, you know, Nixon is fighting against these charges, and he really wanted, you know, to hold out. And, you know, eventually, as we know with Nixon, the public turns against him. More evidence comes out. The media plays a very large role in breaking the Watergate story. And this is part of the end of innocence in some respects of the Americans, you know, kind of love affair with the American presidency, because, you know, first we had LBJ and Vietnam, and there were lies told. Then we have Nixon right on the heels of that. And, you know, public confidence in the institution of the presidency is shot. And, you know, the House was moving to impeach Nixon. And, you know, eventually he decides, rather than be impeached, because that was fairly certain he was going to be, that he would resign. And, mm-hmm. and he did so. But, you know, the public perception there erodes, and it erodes. And the presidency in terms of the institution really has not recovered from the late 60s and early 70s. And again, I think has entered into a different period of really very partisan, much partisanship in terms of how we approve or disapprove of presidents. And it's really not now dependent on what they do or don't do. It's really dependent on, am I in the same partisan category as the president, mm-hmm. To a large degree? And I think we really saw that develop with the Clinton presidency. And so, you know, Nixon is really significant in terms of changing the way we relate to this figure that we are looking at, this approval figure.
And President Nixon, after his time in office, Tim Walz, after his resignation, after a period of what I remember is a sort of relative
right.
silence of being sort of a recluse in California at San Clemente,
right.
Also trying to resuscitate his legacy, his image.
In fact, that is the case. He did it in a fairly low-key way. He did not go out and give public addresses or speeches. He wasn't an outgoing, ebullient kind of person anyway. He spent his time writing books, so primarily thoughtful pieces published in selected, somewhat conservative magazines or foreign policy type magazines, as well as writing books of memoirs and commentary, and in fact, making calls periodically to President Reagan and President Clinton. He was generally accorded the status of, among the presidents who succeeded him as having a first-rate mind, and they would consult him from time to time. But he obviously kept everything low-key. The controversies persisted, of course, because he insisted that the tapes were his property and that they had been seized illegally. So there was extensive litigation with the federal government over who was going to control the tapes, and that affected his legacy.
Before we have to say goodbye for this hour, let's touch on another president. We talked about JFK. I think alongside JFK, Ronald Reagan, thought of as one of the most popular presidents in the modern era. Here is Ronald Reagan, March 4th, 1987. Broadcasting a speech from the Oval Office, expressing regret over a low point in his time in office, over the Iran-Contra scandal, outlining steps to be taken in the wake of a report from a special review board. Let's listen.
First, let me say I take full responsibility for my own actions and for those of my administration. As angry as I may be about activities undertaken without my knowledge, I am still accountable for those activities. As disappointed as I may be in some who served me, I am still the one who must answer to the American people for this behavior. And as personally distasteful as I find secret bank accounts and diverted funds, as the Navy would say, this happened on my watch. Let's start with the part that is the most controversial. A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and my best intentions still tell me that's true. But the facts and the evidence tell me it is not.
Okay, President Reagan from 1987 in the midst of the Iran-Contra scandal. We know President Reagan, Tim Walz, as the Teflon president, came to be known as the president. And we hear that affable tone
right.
There too. What goes into making this president so stick-free Teflon?
Well, first of all, likability. There's no question the American people really liked Ronald Reagan, probably from the time of his acting career. But you also can hear in his measured tones a sense of sincerity. But also, if you parse that speech he gave, he said, well, this happened on my watch. I didn't know anything about it, but it happened on my watch. There's a tendency on the part of the American people to sort of forgive him this mistake because overall they liked him as an individual. And in fact, people still like President Obama. They just given him a terribly low approval rating. And so that one of the reasons Richard Nixon could never recover from Watergate is in part is I don't think the American people liked him very much. And as subjective as that is, I think that has a big effect on popularity ratings as they, you know, are taken by Gallup and other organizations.
Donna Hoffman, if you're still there, I know you have to get off to class, but your comment on the Reagan presidency and how this the scandal didn't stick to him and any other things.
Yeah, well, and you know, at the point that he's making that speech, his approval rating does drop. You know, before this started, it was at 63%. At that first speech, it drops down to 47%. Then it gets down to 43% at the point that he was making that speech. And, you know, the question is, did Reagan recover from that? Yeah, he did. But, you know, basically his approval rating hovered basically at about 50% for the rest of his term until the very end there when it went up as he was leaving office and had, you know, this goodwill. But there is, you know, again, this factor of likability that Tim mentioned that is captured in this particular measure that we apply to all presidents.
You know, we talked about mostly modern era presidents, but Tim Walz, we have about a minute left. Take us back to a president before the modern era you like to pick out in this context.
Well, for example, somebody like I often say, if you talk about what's a low point in somebody's presidency, how about the War of 1812? You know, you're driven out of the White House by the British. The White House is burned. I suspect that if we took polls, James Madison would not get very high marks from the American people for defending the nation. I mean, I think presidents have been fortunate not to have these polls. Maybe we can close with the comment that Alexander Hamilton once said to George Washington, "Your people, sir, are a great beast." And sometimes the beast gets angry and bites back a little bit. And I think that's unfortunately what President Obama is dealing with now, is a surly quality, an angry response to the fact they can't get through on the website and get the health care they want.
Mm-hmm. George Washington, our first president, how much do we know about his popularity in his 8 years? And he was the one who said,
sure,
it would only be eight years. I will not be king.
And keep in mind, Andrew Jackson, when he was running for reelection, there were stories in the newspaper about having fathered illegitimate children and so forth. Politics doesn't necessarily show a great deal of respect or reverence for the presidency. We tend to forget much of that as time goes on. We don't know our history as well as we should, so we tend to live in the moment.
It's been a pleasure to have you with us, stepping into our studio in Iowa City. Presidential historian Tim Walch, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Donna Hoffman, I know you have to dash off. Thank you for joining us in our Cedar Falls studio. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa.
Happy to be here.
Okay. Tomorrow on this program, you'll want to stay tuned. We've got a really interesting program coming up. We're remembering the death of a president, of course, 50 years ago, John F. Kennedy, being shot dead. We'll have reflections from several people you know from our news, University of Iowa President Sally Mason, Jim Leach, our former congressman, Senator Charles Grassley, also Dave Loebsack, Dean Borg, and Tim Walch, all with reflections on the death of JFK. Tune in tomorrow for this program. Thanks to Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, also our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. And tune in tomorrow. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.